calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, day 16 coming up here of the White House stonewalling. Paul Krugman asking his colleagues, he says, so I have a question for my colleagues in the news media. Why isn't the decision by the White House to stonewall the largest corruption scandal since Warren Harding's Teapot Dome considered major news? It's not, apparently, that the White House is refusing after 16 days ago. Scotty McClellan said he would tell us who Jack Abramoff was meeting with in the White House. Jack Abramoff, one of Bush's pioneers, one of his major fundraisers, now refusing to say, we're not going to talk about it. We're not going to go there. Ain't something we want to talk about. No, we're not going to. No, not going to do it. Not going to do it at all. There's a lot in the news. By the way, it's Bernie Sanders is going to be with us, and he's normally with us for this entire hour. However, he's in a meeting right now. There's the, you know, business on the floor of the House and all that sort of thing. So he will be joining us in all probability in about 10 minutes or so, right after the next break. Congressman Bernie Sanders for our Brunch with Bernie segment, which is, you know, our regular segment right now. A whole bunch of stuff in the news that I want to cover today, and we will cover over the course of the next 3 hours. The situation in Bolivia with regard to privatized water. Boy, this is an amazing story. Today is the 25th anniversary of the release of the hostages in Iran, which brings up memories of the October surprise of the Bush-Reagan campaign. We're going to share a little bit with you about that. And HealthSouth's Scrushy, this from this morning's Washington Post. This is, I think, it's not the Washington Post, it's the Associated Press. This is, I think, perhaps one of the most startling stories. And really highlights, really illustrates one of the big problems that we have in Washington, D.C., right, or all across the nation, the Washington, D.C. part of it, that our politicians are captives, essentially, of big money and big money interests. But it's not just our politicians, it turns out. And I want to get into that in just a second. First, I know, you know, a lot of folks are talking about the Bin Laden tape. And, you know, what Osama bin Laden had to say what he had, you know, his whole rant. He said, and for example, as for us, this is from Osama's tape yesterday, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he is still alive. Could be. Either it's him or it's somebody doing a good imitation of him. He says, as for us, we have nothing to lose. A swimmer in the ocean does not fear the rain. You have occupied our lands, offended our honor and dignity, and let out our blood. You have stolen our money, destroyed our houses, played with our security, and we will give you the same treatment. And then he goes on to say, don't let your strength and modern arms fool you. They win a few battles but lose the war. Patience and steadfastness are much better. We were patient in fighting the Soviet Union with simple weapons for 10 years, and we bled their economy, and now they are nothing. In that, there is a lesson for you. And not ever wanting to be one to endorse the comments of Osama bin Laden. I mean, it's just not something that you ought to do. But with the money that we have spent so far in Iraq, the $235,032,755,000, et cetera, we could have provided 11,393,000 full four-year scholarships at public universities. You want America to become competitive? Well, George Bush apparently doesn't. Preschool. We know that preschool, you know, Head Start, preschool programs, things like that, that kids who go through preschool are less likely to end up in jail. They're more likely to end up being productive citizens. We could have paid for 31,130,176 children to attend a year of Head Start. The cost of insurance. We could have insured 140,738,236 kids for a year. Health, dental, eyes, everything. With the $235,032,879,642 and counting that we have spent so far in Iraq. I mean, it's just when you think about what could be done with that money, we could have hired 4,073,148 public school teachers for a full year in the United States with the money that we have spent so far in Iraq. This isn't the money we've allocated. This is just the money we've spent. So anyhow, we'll get back to that as we go along with the program. But it was Scrushy. I want to get back to HealthSouth's Richard Scrushy. This is an amazing thing. This guy was running HealthSouth, and he was making a fortune, in large part off the sale of stock that he owned between 1996 and 2002. In fact, as the Washington Post writes, U.S. Attorney Alice H. Martin highlighted wildly inaccurate securities filings signed by Scrushy. This, by the way, is a crime. Who she said spent more than $200 million on fancy cars, diamond jewelry, and waterfront property, mostly in profit from sales on HealthSouth stock between 1996 and 2002. She said, this is the prosecutor in the case, Richard Scrushy gave phony numbers to the public. The purpose was to make HealthSouth sound like it was, look like it was making more money than it was. Why would he do that? So he could sell his stock at a profit. Why would he do that? So he could spend $200 million on fancy cars, diamond jewelry, and waterfront property. And it's against the law. Key executives are required personally, as the Washington Post notes, to vouch for the numbers they provide regulators and investigators in securities filings, just like you and I are required to vouch personally for our income tax returns. As the Washington Post notes, if those numbers are phony, they face a maximum of 20 years in prison. And Scrushy, according to his subordinates, I mean, a whole bunch of outside, well, again, the Washington Post. Prosecutors have amassed more than a dozen guilty pleas from HealthSouth officials, including all five of the company's former finance chiefs, who all five of these guys agreed to testify against Scrushy in exchange for leniency in sentencing. Now, this was before the case was finished, this article in the Washington Post. This is from March 9, 2005. The case was recently decided, and Scrushy won. He was acquitted. The trial was held down in Birmingham, Alabama. The jury was mostly black, mostly African-American. And it turns out that this from the Associated Press, throughout the six-month trial that led to Richard Scrushy's acquittal in the $2.7 billion fraud at HealthSouth Corp., a small, influential newspaper consistently printed articles sympathetic to the defense of the fired CEO. Audrey Lewis, the author of those stories in the Birmingham Times, the city's oldest black-owned newspaper, now says she was secretly working on behalf of Scrushy, who she says paid her $11,000 through a public relations firm and typically read her articles before publication. The firm wrote another $5,000 check to the Reverend Herman Henderson, who employs Audrey Lewis at his Believer's Temple Church and was among the black preachers supporting Scrushy, who were present in the courtroom throughout. Audrey Lewis and Henderson now say Scrushy owes them $150,000 for the newspaper stories and other PR work, including getting black pastors to attend the trial in a bid to sway the mostly black jury. The payments raise questions about the legitimacy of the ostensibly grassroots support for Scrushy seen throughout his trial. Audrey Lewis's columns were uniformly flattering for the defense. Both before and after the money changed hands, after Scrushy hired the Lewis Group as a PR firm, her stories moved from inside the newspaper to the front page. The day the jurors got the case. Now, these people were not sequestered. They were reading the paper. The Times featured a front page article by Audrey Lewis saying, quote, pastors and community leaders have rallied around Scrushy, showing him the support of the Christian and African-American community, end quote. She says she started out writing these columns because she thought he was innocent, submitted them to the paper for free, and that he liked what he was reading. Scrushy liked the pieces and began paying her to write the articles midway through the case, she says. She said in an interview, he didn't think he was getting a fair shake in the media, which is why he hired me. All right. Scrushy also gave Henderson's church and an associated thrift store five checks totaling $25,000 during and after the trial, according to copies provided by Henderson. So here we have a jury that was apparently, or could have been anyway, heavily influenced by this newspaper, and the newspaper's being paid, and by the presence of ministers from that jury's community, literally sitting in the church every day, or in the courtroom every day, in support of this guy with this $2 billion fraud, where all of the former finance chiefs of HealthSouth testified against him. And the jury found in his favor anyway. And he's paying off the paper. And it appears that while, like, you know, remember Jimmy Hoffa with the Sun Valley Land Trust back in 1960? You know, he tried to bribe a juror and Bobby Kennedy came after him. That's illegal, bribing a juror. But apparently bribing a newspaper editor and a newspaper writer to write about you in a way that will influence the jury is not illegal. And Richard Scrushy has done it. Apparently, if this story by Jay Reeves in the Associated Press today is to be believed, amazing. 16 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman. Mustang Sonny.
Wilson Pickett. Wilson Pickett, 64 years old, died of a heart attack. That's a tough one. Anyhow, welcome back to our program, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln: I'm a firm believer in the people. Given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crises. The great point is to bring them the real facts. Abraham Lincoln, he believed in transparency and honesty in government. Apparently, these guys today don't. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders is back with us now. Hey, Bernie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. Just for any listeners who might have just tuned in, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, the longest-serving member, independent member of the House of Representatives in that body's history, running for the United States Senate as an independent, Bernie.org, his website, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466, if you have a comment or anything you'd like to share, question for Bernie. Very quickly, this weekend is the 33rd anniversary, I believe, of the Roe v. Wade decision.
Right. And that, of course, was a huge victory, not just for women's rights, but for human rights. It said that decisions dealing with some of the most personal and painful decisions that women have to make are going to be made by women themselves and not by the government. And I think we have got to fight tooth and nail to make sure that women continue to have that right. And obviously that right is under assault all over this country. It's certainly under assault in Washington, D.C. And I would say to our male listeners, this is not a woman's issue. This is an issue for all of us, and people have got to stand together to protect the woman's right to choose.
Yeah, and there's going to be a lot of events all over the country on this, Sunday here, and check it out and participate if you can. Jack Abramoff, we are now on day 16, I believe, Bernie, of the White House stonewalling. Any information about their participation with the man who was one of President Bush's major fundraisers, a pioneer?
What is he? No, I didn't know that. What a shock to hear that. I am really shocked.
You didn't know that. What's your take on this whole thing?
Here's the story, and I think we want to be very clear about this. What Abramoff is about is a symptom of the corruption that exists in Washington, D.C. And let me tell you what it's about.
Before you go any farther, can I just ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
Has Jack Abramoff ever given you any money?
No, no, he has not.
Okay. He's never visited you?
Never come to the office to say hello. No, he has not. The issue here is not, and we shouldn't be confused by this, is not that somebody took a golf trip to Scotland. That's nickels and dimes. The real issue here, and what Abramoff touches on, is the absolute degree to which big money controls virtually everything that goes on in our nation's capital today. And that is a real, real tragedy. And what it's about is that if legislation is going to get to the floor of the House in Tom DeLay's Congress, by and large, that legislation is bought and paid for by big money interests. And you go right down the line. I remember in terms of trade policies and our disastrous trade policies, which are wiping out so many manufacturing jobs in America, just in the last trade agreement, a CAFTA, it was written right up in the Washington, D.C. newspapers that lobbyists and campaign contributors were threatening any Republican who voted against CAFTA, they were not going to get their campaign contributions. It wasn't much more subtle than that. In terms of this absolutely nightmarish prescription drug Medicare bill that millions of seniors are struggling with right now, an absolutely absurd bill, the guy who wrote that bill was Billy Towson, the then chairman of the House Commerce Committee. Tom, do you know where Billy Towson is working today?
Let me guess, Bernie. Might he be making millions of bucks from the pharmaceutical industry?
Oh, my God, you are. That is why you're the host of the show. You
I'm
are
psychic.
I'm
psychic.
Yes, he is now the head of pharma. I know that will shock the listeners. The bankruptcy bill was written by the credit card companies and the banks. The energy bill was written by the oil companies and the nuclear power industry. That's the way it goes. And we have reached the stage, almost literally, where it is not the members of Congress who actually write the legislation for these big corporations. The corporations write it for members of Congress. And that's what Tom DeLay's Congress about, and that's what this whole thing is about.
And so how do we change this? I mean, yesterday on this program, I called for public financing of elections.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's a difficult issue, by the way, and it's something that we have to figure out very well how you do.
Right, because it raises First Amendment issues.
But I believe that what we're seeing in, we've seen it in Maine, we've seen it in Arizona, we've seen it in cities like San Fran, various cities in this country.
Yeah, here in Portland, Oregon.
You have it in Portland now?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. And basically what it's about, I think common sense suggests that democracy should not be about some guy who can spend 10 times more or 50 times more than somebody else who is either himself or herself extraordinarily wealthy or beholden to big money interests. That's not what American democracy is supposed to be about. We're supposed to be about a clash of ideas, not somebody being able to outspend somebody else 5-1 or 10-1. That's clearly what's going on in America today. So public funding of elections, to me, makes a lot of sense, and I think we should move down that path.
Well said. We're talking with Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. His website, bernie.org, B-E-R-N-I-E.org. Our number, 440-8466. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down.
And welcome back. You're light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. 34 minutes past the hour. Bernie Sanders with us. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, the longest serving member of the House of Representatives, independent member of the House of Representatives. And running for the Senate, his website, Bernie.org. Bernie.org. Our phone number, 1-866-440-8466. And, Bernie, shall we go to the phones here?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's see here. Dick in Dayton, Ohio. Dick, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Congressman Bernie. How are you today?
Good, Dick.
Yeah, I just want to make a real point. You know, being from Ohio, you see all these cuts. And you see it in the nation. What I want to ask you, Congressman, I write the media about this. Is there any way we can stop these, like the Medicare cuts, the library
absolutely.
Cuts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. These, Dick, are cuts being done.
Yes.
Right-wing extremists who could care less about the middle class and working families of this country, who work day and night to make the wealthiest people in this country wealthier, the largest corporations more profitable. We have a situation right now where this budget reconciliation bill cuts back on Medicaid at a time when our health care system is disintegrating, cuts back, if you can believe it, on financial aid for college students when the cost of college is soaring, cuts back on nutrition programs. It is an absolute outrage, and then the Republicans want to give even more tax breaks to millionaires or billionaires. We've got to rally the American people to say that the function of government is not to attack the middle class and give huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people. Can we do it? We sure can. But we need Congress to have the courage to stand up to the big money interests who have so much power today.
Well said. Mike in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Mike, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Well, I want to say that the solution to this problem is so simple the mind repels it. We need a dramatic increase in the number of representatives and such that you know, the constituency sizes are currently 600 and some odd thousand people for each representative, and it makes it almost impossible to overcome big money in a campaign. In smaller constituencies, it is possible to go out and run out of your own pocket and defeat some of these guys.
So, Mike, you're suggesting that we need to amend the Constitution to expand the number of members of the House of Representatives?
No, sir. The Constitution says 30,000 per representative. We don't need to amend a thing. There isn't an amendment. You don't need to
I believe the 14th Amendment changed that, didn't it?
It did not, sir.
Oh, okay.
I don't know the answer, and Mike may be right about it, but I have to tell you, Mike, I don't think that that is the answer. I think that the answer right now moves much more in the direction of public funding of elections. I think that you can have smaller bodies, and you see it all over this country, where you have small cities also dominated by the big downtown business people, state legislatures dominated by big money. I think we have got to figure out a way to take the power of big money out of the political process and restore our country toward a vibrant democracy where ordinary people can have their wishes heard by their government.
Marvin in Fort Worth, Texas, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, good afternoon. I need to comment. I'm wondering if the congressman has any idea how much chance there is of anything actually being done that will amount to anything up there.
You mean positive change?
Marvin, given the fact that you have right-wing Republicans controlling the House, right-wing Republicans controlling the Senate, right-wing Republicans controlling the White House, not a whole lot is going to happen that benefits the needs of the middle class and working families. This president, for example, is in outsourcing, has told corporate America he thinks it's a great idea that they continue to send our jobs to China and other countries. Instead of moving us toward a national health care program, he wants to cut back on Medicaid and other programs. So unless we get rid of these guys in power and bring some other people in who are going to start representing working families, I am not optimistic that much positive is going to happen.
Blaine in Texarkana, Arkansas. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, how are you doing today? Hey, Bernie.
Good.
At the start of the year, you know, every news group was getting financial predictions from various experts, and I recall listening to an interview with the founder of the Vanguard Group, whose name escapes me, and who was also a Republican. His prediction was that the Democrats would take back 12 to 20 seats in the House and gain control, but he also predicted that the damage had been done, you know, to the economy so bad with regards to tax breaks and the wealthy that the change in power is not going to make a difference. And I'll quote him. He said, "If you're rich, the economy is going to be good for years to come, but the middle class is going to continue to struggle." I was curious, do you agree with that?
I hope not, but I think he makes an important point. The damage is so severe. Our trade policies have been so disastrous. The attacks on our pension system, on our health care system, have been so great that it's going to take a great deal of fortitude in Washington to bring about changes. But right now, the middle class is shrinking. Poverty is increasing. It is going to take a lot of work to reverse that. And I hope and believe that we can do that. I believe that we can do that, but it's going to take a lot of work. But certainly right now, it is the wealthy and large corporations who are in the driver's seat and are doing very well.
Brian in Manchester, New Hampshire, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Today, gentlemen, I can't really talk about anything abstract. I want to talk about Army Specialist Douglas Barber. He was a returned Iraq War veteran. He appeared on a radio talk show December 16th. And just this last Monday, Martin Luther King Day, January 16th at 2:30 p.m. Opelika, Alabama time, on the front of his trailer, he put a gun to his head and killed himself. Douglas Barber, rest in peace. God love you. You're with Martin Luther King, the only true king in American history. And, sirs, he had post-traumatic stress disorder. He did not get nearly enough care that he needed, and he put the gun to his head, but he did not kill himself. That was done. I say that mission was accomplished by this unelected bunch of traitors and war profiteers in Washington. They are responsible for Douglas Barber's death, as they are for tens of thousands of Iraqis and thousands of Americans, and there's many more Douglas Barbers, men and women brave, our best and brightest coming home that we need to care for, Congressman. Can you help us with that?
Okay, let me, and if you're from the, maybe you know a little bit about this. First of all, you are absolutely right in talking about this tragedy. And in understanding, and sometimes we forget this, you know, we talk about 2,200 Americans who have died in Iraq, as well as tens of thousands of Iraqis, but we neglect the fact that over 15,000 have been wounded, and at least half of those have been seriously wounded. And we also do not talk about enough the absolute underfunding of the VA hospital system and healthcare system. And if you read what groups like the VFW and the American Legion of Disabled American Veterans and the Vietnam Veterans of America talk about, what they say is that our system today is not able today to care for our older veterans, let alone the thousands who are going to be coming back from Iraq. So it's not only the 15,000 that have been wounded in Iraq, physically wounded. What we also understand, and studies tell us, is that the rate of post-traumatic stress disorder is now higher for those returning from Iraq than it was for those returning from Vietnam. And in fact, we have gotten some money in Vermont, and actually it helps New Hampshire as well, I think, to develop programs to better reintegrate these people back into the community and into their families. We did that a little bit in Vermont. We have some good programs. But we need a lot more in Vermont. We need a lot more all over this country. And I get very tired, to tell you the truth, of hearing this president tell us how much he loves the troops, how much he respects the troops, and yet the kinds of budget that he is presenting for the VA is totally, totally inadequate. So what we're getting is hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks for the wealthiest 1%, and then when the veterans are demanding a few billion dollars to make sure that our veterans get the treatment that they need, somehow he can't find that money, and that is a real outrage.
Well said. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie.
How you doing, Armin?
Okay, let's go back this week. It's Friday now. Wednesday, the Bush crime family is basically politically boxed in. Thursday, Bin Laden rolls out his scary tape. Friday, down here in Florida, gas is touching $2.50 a gallon. And we know that the Bin Laden family is, we're sure, pretty much, that they're invested in with the Carlyle Group. So the question I have to you is, do you think covertly it's very likely that Bin Laden is still on the U.S. payroll?
No, I don't. And I think we want to be a little bit careful, Armin, about conspiracy theories. I don't believe that. But what I do believe, in terms of the rising price of gasoline, it's getting higher and higher in Vermont as well, is I want to know why so long after Katrina, the price of gasoline now is going higher and higher. We know that last quarter, Tom, you remember this, we discussed mm-hmm. this at great length.
Yeah.
Our friends at ExxonMobil had, a $10 billion?
They had the biggest profit in the history of the planet. Literally.
Well, let me make a guess, and we'll see if I'm right or wrong, but that their next quarter profits are going to be very high as well. So I think what they are trying to do is get the American people accustomed to gas at $2.50 a gallon or whatever it may be, and shove it down our throats. And this is an issue, of course, if we had a Congress that represented ordinary people and working people and not just large corporations, there would be hearings trying to understand why the price of gas is as high as it is.
There you go. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org is his website. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the True People's Radio. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back right after this, my friends. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home.
And welcome back, my friends, to News Without Conflicts and Global Corporate Interest. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 9.5 minutes before the hour, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, Bernie.org, his website. And Dave in Eureka, California, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hey, Bernie, dear man, you are right on. I have two quick questions for you, if I might. One is that a couple of months ago, it was Harry Reid shut down the Senate calling for an inquiry into why did we get lied into the Iraq war? How did that happen? And then, boom, it suddenly went dead. But two, I can't talk to a member of Congress without bringing up the subject that as long as they keep these crooked voting machines from maintaining, from having any record for us, that means they're planning to do it to us again. And they just keep going on, getting away with it. There are little precincts with a couple hundred voters delivering 6,000-7,000 GOP votes. We got to do something about that.
Yeah.
That's my two questions.
Okay, very good. Very good questions, Dave. I mean, I think the terms of the voting machine situation, and Tom, I know, has talked about this a whole lot and written about it. It's clearly a situation where we have to make sure what democracy is about is that when you cast a vote, you have absolute 100% certainty that that vote is counted accurately. There are millions of Americans who have concerns that that is not the case. It is beyond comprehension that companies like Diebold can believe that they have the right to maintain quote-unquote proprietary information about the process when this is the public business, not Diebold's business. And I'm always amazed. Canada's going to have an election very soon. They get their results out in a couple of hours. No one ever questions their results. I think they do it through paper ballots, as a matter of fact.
Yep.
Is that the case, Tom?
Yeah.
Clearly wrong in the system, and it's got to change. Congress, we have some legislation in there. It's not supported by the Republicans. We should be moving at the state and local level as well. This is an issue we have got to take very seriously.
Yeah. And Senator Reid's investigation of the Iraq...
Reid did exactly the right thing. The American people are entitled to know what George Bush knew and when he knew it. And it is not good enough for this president to blame the intelligence agencies for giving him faulty information when there is a great deal of evidence to suggest that many people in the intelligence agencies were giving him good information. But he chose to take all of that information, which suggested that Iraq had a weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq was working with Osama bin Laden. He chose to go in that direction, and he ignored a lot of information that told him otherwise. We need to know all about that. We certainly need an investigation. And one of the outrages of many that is taking place in Congress right now, and I'm on the committee that does this, when Bill Clinton was president, there was nothing that guy could do that wasn't investigated. 5 years after Bush, all of the things that happened, not just Iraq, not one major investigation. The Republican Party has created a rubber stamp Congress and is not doing their constitutional responsibility of oversight.
Jay in Atlanta, Georgia, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
A few months ago, I asked both of you about how we're going to deal with the constitutional crisis and should we have him impeached, should we force him to resign. And in so many words, you told me, you know, don't expect that to happen. It's not realistic because we have a Republican Congress. Well, right now in C-SPAN, they're having a live hearing about the NSA situation. They've had several lawyers, including assistant attorney for Reagan. They've all said, no uncertain terms, he needs to resign, and if he won't resign, he needs to be impeached. So
this is John Conyers' hearing that's on C-SPAN
right now.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, now, A, that looks to me like we're looking at a full-blown constitutional crisis. So is it really that naive for me to think, why doesn't someone such as Reverend Billy Graham, who's got prominence and clout with Bush and the whole country, and go to Bush and say, look, you really need to go to the Democrats and work out some kind of deal and say, I'm going to resign and Kerry or whoever will take my place. Because
who will take your place? Kerry?
Well, Kerry won the election, we all know.
Ain't
going to happen.
Come up with a better solution, please.
It's obviously not going to happen. It doesn't happen. If by some chance the president was taken out of office, it was impeached or whatever, the new president would be Dick Cheney. That's what happens. I think that there needs to be, as I mentioned a moment ago, you know, if John Conyers is having a hearing today, it is not an official hearing, because John is just the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, not the chairman. If the Democrats come back into power, then you'll have an official hearing. But right now what we need are hearings and investigations to explore those issues. And my strong guess is that so long as the Republicans continue to control the House and the Senate, that is not going to happen. But to say
the least, no, I don't think John Kerry is going to be appointed president of the United States.
Yeah. John Conyers, just so our listeners are clear about it, John Conyers was on our program, in fact, last week. He spoke very highly of you. His hearings about what happened in Ohio, those were unofficial because the Democrats don't control the House of Representatives,
right.
So he does not have subpoena power. So he can hold the hearings, he can have people testify, but they are not at all, quote, legal, end quote. There's
right.
no
They're
official
not,
nature
I mean,
to them.
John is a good friend of mine, and as I said, if the Democrats could take control of the House, John becomes the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. What John has done over the last couple of years is hold unofficial hearings and meetings, which have gotten a lot of media attention, which have educated the American people on things like the Downing Street memo. So John is doing a great job. But what people have got to understand, that many people do not, when we talk about Republican control over the House and Senate, they control every committee. Nothing official happens without their blessing. And let me tell you, they're not about, unless we could put massive pressure on them to do hearings on how we got into Iraq and Bush's role in that, and did he want to invade Iraq before 9/11, all those kinds of questions that the American people want asked and discussed and hearing from the administration. We want to hear what their point of view is. We want to hear them defend themselves. That's not going to happen, unless I'm mistaken, so long as the Republicans retain control in the House and the Senate.
So it all boils down to our becoming politically active and getting Democrats elected in 06.
Well, I think that is terribly important, yes.
And independence.
Yes.
There you go. Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment, Bernie's website, bernie.org, www.bernie.org. Check it out. Bernie's running for the United States Senate right now, and I say good luck to you, Bernie, and I encourage everybody to do whatever they can to help out in any way they can. Bernie, thanks so much. Thanks so much for being with us. Yep. Talk to you again then. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here. We're helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Larry C. Johnson is a decorated veteran of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, as well as the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. He's the CEO of Berg Associates, got his start in the CIA in 1985 through a letter of recommendation from Republican Senator Orrin Hatch. Left the CIA in 1989 and was a registered Republican who supported President Bush in 2000. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am absolutely great, and it's always wonderful to have you on the program here, Larry.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're doing a great job here, and particularly, you know, since the outing of Valerie Plame, you know, you've talked with us on this program several times about that. One of our callers, Rick in Grand Rapids, has a question about this Osama bin Laden tape. You mind taking a call right off the bat here? Okay, Rick, you're live with Larry Johnson.
Mr. Johnson? Hi, Rick. How are you? I've seen you on several of the cable shows. I mean, I got to tell you something. I was watching cable news last night, and I see Bill O'Reilly, Newt Gingrich, Joe Scarborough, and Tucker Carlson, who claims he's against the war in Iraq. They were all positively giddy because they said all of the talking points in that bin Laden tape, if it really was bin Laden, echoes so much of what the Democrats are saying. And they're saying, we're not saying the Democrats are as bad as bin Laden. Now, my question...
But almost.
Pardon me?
But almost is the... Yeah.
But my question is, we know bin Laden, at least I think he was somehow tangentially at least involved with the CIA when he was our ally, more or less, against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And given the fact that the CIA, I know, has the capability to probably doctor a tape, how do we know this whole thing isn't a total phony just to make the Democrats look bad?
Well, number one, I reject the entire proposition that Scarborough, O'Reilly, and those other clowns were advancing, that somehow what is in bin Laden's tape reflects what the views of Democrats are. I mean, that's just sheer utter nonsense. And, you know, unless people just need to take the time and read what bin Laden said. The voice analysis on it from folks I've talked to seem pretty convinced that this is not a ginned up job, that this is, in fact does reflect bin Laden. I think where the focus really needs to be is that George Bush has been all over the board on this. I mean, one point he's like, we're going to get him dead or alive. And the next point he, you know, has a form of Alzheimer's disease on television because he just said, oh, who's bin Laden, and he's not that important. Well, what the facts are is that the administration has not made tracking bin Laden an important priority. Instead, they've diverted resources into Iraq. And right now, I mean, it's not a matter of my opinion. It's just the facts on the ground. Our activities in Iraq have led to an unprecedented surge in the level of international terrorist activity, and it's the best recruiting tool for Osama bin Laden. So I would encourage you to go back and take a look at Milt Bearden's book that he wrote with Jim Risen titled The Main Enemy. Milt was the guy on the ground working with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. There were 8 different groups. They covered the spectrum from the most extremist of Islamists to, you know, folks who were fairly moderate. But in that time, we were not working directly with bin Laden. Bin Laden shared a goal with us, but he was working more closely with a guy by the name of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar.
Okay, great. By the way, Larry Johnson's website is www.noquarter.typepad.com. Noquarter.typepad.com. Larry, if you know, we're in complete agreement on this thing that George W. Bush basically after 9/11 and particularly after, you know, halfway through the activity in Afghanistan, decided all of a sudden to just, you know, pack up and go off to Iraq, has provided bin Laden with the best recruiting tool possible. How should, you know, in the best of possible worlds, I mean, given your background in the CIA and your knowledge of al-Qaeda, what should he have done?
He needs to put someone in charge that would have a complete interagency task force. What I mean by, here's the current situation. If you go to Pakistan and ask the CIA chief of station there who's in charge of finding bin Laden, he'll tell you he is. If you go to Kabul and ask the CIA chief over there who's in charge, he'll tell you he is. If you go to the counterterrorism center, they'll tell you they are. If you go to the military, to the Special Operations Command, they'll tell you they are. You've got at least 5 different groups that I can count who each claim to be that they're in charge of finding bin Laden, and yet they're not working together. Just a quick example. A year ago, I was shown a list of the top targets for the military of the al-Qaeda organization. And in the course of the discussion, it came up with something about the CIA, and I was informed CIA has a completely separate list. This explains in part why we keep hearing that there are so many number twos that we keep getting.
Yeah,
because
we've killed 3 or 4 of them so far.
The list. And so what needs to happen is that you need to bring together a complete interagency operation that would include the intelligence community, that would include the military, that would include law enforcement, which means both FBI and DEA. And you bring them all together, and you can find this guy. But they haven't done it, haven't made it a priority. And so as a result, here's bin Laden more than 4 years later telling his followers, hey, guys, God's on my side because Americans, despite all of their power, can't touch me.
Right. And in fact, 3 years ago, I mean, people say, you know, why haven't we gotten bin Laden? 3 years ago, George W. Bush, you know, what he had to say about it was...
I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him. I'll be honest with you. Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
Yeah, and
I rest my case.
Yeah, there you go. Now, Larry, this was literally just as you were speaking, was handed to me by somebody from the newsroom here in the where we're broadcasting from, and this is off the AP wire. Literally, just came down in the last few seconds. President Bush is launching a public relations campaign to answer critics of his domestic spying program. Now, he's not able to find bin Laden. He can't spy on bin Laden, but he wants to spy on you and me.
Yeah.
Next week, he'll visit the headquarters of the ultra-secret NSA, and other top officials will give speeches on the program. The goal, this is from the Associated Press, is to convince Americans that the snooping is vital to the war on terror and doesn't trample civil liberties. Congress is set to hold hearings early next month, and spokesman Scotty McClellan says the president wants to, quote, educate the American people ahead of those hearings. End quote. Bush's authorization allows, well, then it goes into the details of what it is. What's going on with this? I mean, you used to be a spook.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the, The reason they're not getting FISA warrants is because the information most likely comes out of secret prisons and interrogations where possible torture was used.
You think that that what Bush is trying to hide is the fact that he was committing crimes to get information that he was then using to wiretap?
Well,
I
put it this way, that crimes may have been committed in gathering the information, and they didn't want to have to divulge that to the judge.
Now, what about the possibility that's been floated? You know, here we have Alan Greenspan's wife, Andrea Mitchell, senior NBC reporter or whatever, asking James Risen if Christian Amanpour was one of those who was being wiretapped. Now, her husband, Jamie Rubin, was the guy who was standing in for John Kerry during the campaign of 2004 on a lot of radio and TV shows, doing a lot of talking heads things. And, could it be that part of what Bush was doing was wiretapping his political opponents, and that's why he didn't want to go before a court?
I think that's another possibility, definitely. And I think that needs to be considered. The excuses the administration have offered are just so completely lame and not without and without any foundation, yet most of the mainstream media appears to go along with it. For example, they said, well, you know, this is quick moving information, and we didn't have time to get a FISA warrant. Excuse me, DEA, starting 10 years ago, was able to track real-time phone calls that were, you know, they captured a terrorist in New York City by the name of Kiki Mosquera, a guy that blew up an Avianca plane. And they did this within the FISA process.
Right.
So there is, knowing what I know about the intelligence community, there is absolutely no scenario in which the urgency of action is such that they would not be able to justify a FISA warrant. That's just a complete red herring that's been put out there.
Larry, we have just a little less than a minute left, and I'm wondering, you know, as a former member of the intelligence community, a former CIA officer, it seems to me that the intelligence community is taking a hit right now with this. I mean, a lot of people aren't just thinking of it as Bush is listening in on us. It's like, you know, the spies out there are listening in on us.
Right.
Do you think that there's going to be significant blowback, or is there already significant blowback against the Bush administration from the intelligence community itself about his mishandling of them?
This is deja vu all over again. It harkens back to the Frank Church hearings in the 1970s. Where the CIA was portrayed as a rogue elephant. And when you really parsed through all the words, what you found was the CIA was carrying out the orders of presidents that started back under the Dwight Eisenhower and went through Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And so the intelligence community, I think, I like to refer to it as a dog eager to go for a walk, not some rampaging beast that's working on its own.
Yeah.
And this is where the importance of holding political leaders accountable is so important.
Yeah, because really we've got a lot of good people in the intelligence community, and they have to answer to politicians who apparently in some cases are not such good people.
That's correct.
Not to completely draw it in black and white, but I think there's a lot of reality to that.
Yes,
Larry Johnson, noquarter.typepad.com. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, Mom. It's me, Osama. I guess you're worrying, wondering where I've been staying. Got in a world of trouble, lit out on the double, hiding out in Pakistan. I'm eating good, I'm praying.
Good old Osama, indeed. Well, we hear from him again. 21 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman radio program. President Bush launching a public relations campaign to answer critics of his domestic spying program. I don't believe it. It's just, well, actually, I do believe it. It's tragic. Absolutely tragic. Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Greg, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today? Greg Gorman?
This is how the administration is.
I'm sorry. Say it again.
I said, you know you believe that.
Yeah, I know. It's that's the thing. I mean, it's
that's
like
how the administration
their answer to every problem is launch a PR campaign and try and convince people that up is down, black is white, you know, red is green, whatever, and they're going about it again.
Well, you know, I know this morning you actually spoke to someone. You know, we're here at the Treasury Economic Radio Day today, and it's kind of the same thing. You know, they're trying to show that the economy is growing and that the administration has and is actually been responsible for the growth in the economy. And they've, you know, been trotting out Rove. You know, Karl Rove was here, Dan Bartlett was here, the Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary of Labor, Lane Chow was here, and they're all kind of saying the same thing.
I mean, the simple question to these bozos is, if I borrowed $2 billion a day and spent that money domestically, which is what this government is doing, and the vast majority of that money is being spent inside the United States, if I borrowed $2 billion a day and spent it domestically, I could show you an economy that looks like it's doing okay. You know, what would this economy look like if you guys were not borrowing $2 billion a day?
Well, exactly. And, of course, that doesn't really come up. It's something called the Treasury Economic Radio Day when you're sitting in the Treasury Department.
Why doesn't it come up, Greg?
Well, it does, but, I mean, let's put it this way. It could, but I don't know if anyone from the administration would give us a straight answer to that question.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is PR.
Yeah. You guys are sufficiently heretical that you're not worried. You don't have the Helen Thomas fear or really the NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN fear that if you ask the wrong question, you'll never be called on again, do you? With Talk Radio News?
Well, we haven't been called on for over 2 years now.
so you've asked the wrong question.
I don't know if it's something that we have to worry about. We sort of know the answer to that question.
It's behind you now.
And, Tom, I can also tell you this. For any kind of press conference in the Roosevelt Room or in the East Room of the White House, we're usually in the fourth or fifth row on the side.
Yeah, kind of the back of the bus, in other words.
Exactly.
So what's happening in Washington, D.C. overall today?
Well, you know, the other thing that's going on is we've heard from Senator Reid, who's now – he apologized, in essence, you know, for a news release that he put out that said that more of the GOP is corrupt and has ethics problems than maybe some of them do. So he actually turned on a dime and apologized.
Why?
Trying to keep the congenial nature of the Senate. He respects the nature of the Senate and its rules, and he's trying to say that you know, this memo where he said that there are problems of ethics in the GOP went too far. So, you know, if you're a Democrat, you think that Senator Reid has actually turned on a dime and actually turned on the wrong dime because now he's sort of put his own party at a disadvantage.
He needs to apologize for his apology.
Well, that's exactly what
come on, Harry Reid. Jeez, I'm just astounded. The toll-free number for Congress, my friends, is 888-355-3588. Call your senators and give them hell. I don't know what to say beyond that.
Well, and of course, staying on the Senate, of course, like you and I have talked every other day this week, you know, there are more senators on the Democratic side who have said now they will vote against Judge Alito. It still doesn't seem to make a difference. He will probably be confirmed. Of course, he'll have fewer votes than Justice Roberts had when he was confirmed. But there are, you know, there are Democrats who have now said, of course, we'll vote against him because we don't believe that his, you know, in the vein of checks and balances, he understands what checks and balances are. His questions and answers were wishy-washy, and they are afraid about how the court will look and what the court will be when it's Justice Alito, not Judge Alito.
I spoke with Senator Ron Wyden this morning, and he declared that he is going to vote against Alito. He did not say whether or not he would support a filibuster. He said it's premature to be discussing it, which says to me that he hasn't ruled that out, although, you know, I'm just speculating. Ben Nelson has come out in favor of Alito, the one Democrat so far that I know of. Do you know of any others?
No, in fact, you know, I was just about to say the only one we've heard of is Senator Nelson of Nebraska. Tom, I don't know if I told you this either, but a few weeks ago I spoke to a source who knows Harry Reid's office very well, an inside source who says in the beginning Senator Reid was considering the filibuster, but for the last, you know, at least week and a half, he has really not considered the filibuster as an option. So unless something changes over the next 3 or 4 days, there will not be a filibuster.
And it's Harry Reid is going to be the guy who's going to call it. He runs the Democrats, the Senate for the Democrats in the Senate. Call Harry Reid's office at 888-355-3588. Toll free.
Call, send emails. You know,
there you go. 888-355-3588. A filibuster is where a senator takes the floor and says, that's it, I'm going to start talking and I'm not going to stop, basically shuts down the Senate, and the only way to break a filibuster is to get 60 votes, and the Republicans don't have 60 votes, or maybe they do, I don't know, with Ben Nelson, but we'll see. But a filibuster, I think, is really called for here. The Sam Alito guy is toxic. He is toxic. Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much, Greg, for the report today.
Always nice to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you with us, Greg. It's the place where smart people get their news, news without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartmann Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends.
People asking questions. Lost in confusion.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Our caller earlier from Grand Rapids, as I recall, pointing out that last night the Republicans on all the various, you know, talking heads on the cable shows were all just giddy with glee about the Bin Laden tape, because they said Bin Laden was putting forward the Democratic Party's talking points. And by the way, they always refer to him as the Democrat Party. There's no such thing as the Democrat Party. I keep waiting. You know, Dede Meyers was on with one of these cons the other day, and he kept referring to the Democrat Party, and I kept waiting for her to say, there is no such thing as the Democrat Party. It's called the Democratic Party. And the Democrats continue to allow the Republicans to get away with this. But in any case, my guess is that, you know, nobody is playing the full text of this thing and of Bin Laden's message. And so, you know, most Americans have no idea what's being talked about, and so all they're getting is basically the spin on it. And so I thought I would share, you know, a good chunk of it with you, just straight up, without commentary. This is the message purported to be from Osama bin Laden, as translated by the Associated Press. Bin Laden appears to be addressing the American people. My message to you is about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and how to end them. I do not intend to speak to you about this because this issue has already been decided. Only metal breaks metal. And our situation, thank God, is only getting better and better, while your situation is the opposite of that. But I plan to speak about the repeated errors your President Bush has committed in comments on the results of your polls that show an overwhelming majority of you want the withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. But he, Bush, has opposed this wish and said that withdrawing troops sends the wrong message to opponents, and that it is better to fight them, Bin Laden's followers, on their own land than fighting Americans on American land. I can reply to these errors by saying that war in Iraq is raging with no let-up, and operations in Afghanistan are escalating in our favor, thank God. And Pentagon figures show the number of your dead and wounded is increasing, not to mention the massive material losses, the destruction of the soldiers' morale there, and the rise in cases of suicide among them. So you can imagine the state of psychological breakdown that afflicts a soldier as he gathers the remains of his colleagues after they stepped on landmines that tore them apart. After this situation, the soldier is caught between two hard options. He either refuses to leave his military camp on patrols and is therefore dogged by ruthless punishments enacted by the Vietnam butcher, the U.S. Army, or he gets destroyed by the mines. This puts him under psychological pressure, fear, and humiliation, while his nation is ignorant of what is going on. The soldier has no solution except to commit suicide. This is a strong message to you, written by his soul, blood, and pain, to save what can be saved from this hell. The solution is in your hands if you care about your soldiers. The news of our brother Mujahideen is different from what the Pentagon publishes. They, the news of Mujahideen, and what the media report is the truth of what is happening on the ground. And what deepens the doubt over the White House's information is the fact that it targets the media reporting the truth from the ground. And it has appeared lately, supported by documents, that the butcher of freedom in the world, Bush, has decided to bomb the headquarters of Al Jazeera in Qatar after bombing its offices in Kabul and Baghdad. On another issue, jihad, holy war, is ongoing, thank God, despite all the oppressive measures. Let me just, for those who just tuned in, I'm reading... sharing with you Bin Laden's missive. You can make up your own mind what it means. We've got all these talking heads telling us what he's saying. I think most people don't know what he said, and so I'm just going to share, you know, as much of it as I can with you in this segment. On another issue, jihad is ongoing, thank God, he said, despite all the oppressive measures adopted by the U.S. Army and its agents, which is to a point where there is no difference between his criminality and Saddam's criminality, as it has reached the degree of raping women and taking them as hostages instead of their husbands. As for torturing men, they have used burning chemical acids and drills on their joints, and when they give up on interrogating them, they sometimes use the drills on their heads until they die. Read, if you will, the reports of the horrors in Abu Ghraib and the Guantanamo prisons. And I say that despite all the barbaric methods, they have not broken the fierceness of the resistance. The Mujahideen, this says Osama bin Laden, the Mujahideen, thank God, are increasing in number and strength, so much so that reports point to the ultimate failure and defeat of the unlucky quartet of Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz. Declaring this defeat is just a matter of time, depending partly on how much the American people know of the size of this tragedy. The sensible people realize that Bush does not have a plan to make his alleged victory in Iraq come true. And if you compare the small number of dead on the day that Bush announced the end of major operations, again, we're reading from Osama bin Laden's statement yesterday, and if you compare the small number of dead on the day that Bush announced the end of major operations in that fake, ridiculous show aboard the aircraft carrier with the tenfold number of dead and wounded who were killed in the smaller operations, you would know the truth of what I say. This is that Bush and his administration do not have the will or the ability to get out of Iraq for their own private, suspect reasons. And so, says Osama bin Laden, to return to the issue, I say that results of polls please those who are sensible, and Bush's opposition to them is a mistake. The reality shows that the war against America and its allies has not been limited to Iraq, as he, Bush, claims. Iraq has become a point of attraction and restorer of our energies, says bin Laden. At the same time, the Mujahideen, with God's grace, have managed repeatedly to penetrate all security measures adopted by the unjust allied countries. The proof of this is the explosions you have seen in the capitals of the European nations who are in this aggressive coalition. The delay in similar measures happening in America has not been because of failure to break through your security measures. The operations are under preparation, and you will see them in your homes the minute they are through with preparations, with God's permission. Again, we're quoting Osama bin Laden here. Make up your own mind. Is it real? Is it not? What does it mean? Anyhow, back to bin Laden. Based on what has been said, this shows the errors of Bush's statement, the one that slipped from him, which is at the heart of polls calling for withdrawing the troops. It is better that Americans don't fight Muslims on their lands and that they don't fight us on ours. We don't mind offering you a long-term truce on fair conditions that we adhere to. We are a nation that God has forbidden to lie and cheat. So both sides can enjoy security and stability under this truce so we can build Iraq and Afghanistan, which have been destroyed in this war. There is no shame in this solution, which prevents the wasting of billions of dollars that have gone to those with influence and the merchants of war in America, who have supported Bush's election campaign with billions of dollars, which lets us understand the insistence by Bush and his gang to carry on with war. If you Americans are sincere, says Osama bin Laden, if you Americans are sincere in your desire for peace and security, we have answered you. And if Bush decides to carry on with his lies and oppression, then it would be useful for you to read the book Rogue State, which states in its introduction, now bin Laden quoting the book Rogue State, which, by the way, is a... Over the last couple of days, I looked on Amazon. It's now a major bestseller. If I were president, I would stop the attacks on the United States. First, I would give an apology to all the widows and orphans and those who were tortured. Then I would announce that American interference in the nations of the world has ended once and for all. End of quote from the book. We're still quoting Osama bin Laden. Finally, I say that war will go either in our favor or yours. If it is the former, it means your loss and your shame forever. And it is headed in this course. If it is the latter, read history. We are people who do not stand for injustice, and we will seek revenge all our lives. The nights and days will not pass without us taking vengeance, like on September 11, God permitting. Your minds will be troubled, and your lives embittered. As for us, this is the part that we're of bin Laden's speech here yesterday that concerns me the most. He says, as for us, we have nothing to lose. A swimmer in the ocean does not fear the rain. You have occupied our lands, offended our honor and dignity, let out our blood, stolen our money, destroyed our houses, and played with our security, and we will give you the same treatment. You have tried to prevent us from leading a dignified life, but you will not be able to prevent us from a dignified death. Failing to carry out jihad, which is called for in our religion, is a sin. The best death to us is under the shadows of swords. Don't let your strength and modern arms fool you. They win a few battles but lose the war. patience, and steadfastness are much better. We were patient in fighting the Soviet Union with simple weapons for 10 years, and we bled their economy, and now they are nothing. In that, there is a lesson for you. End of speech. That's the entire thing. That was the entire message from Osama bin Laden. So you can make up your own mind. Are all the talking heads on TV right in saying, oh, bin Laden is putting out the Democratic talking points? Or, you know, is this really bin Laden speaking? I have to say, I honestly don't know. You know, I had thought the guy was dead. I'm just not sure right now. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Greg in Grand Rapids. Hey, Greg, you said I misquoted Glenn Beck?
Yeah, I think that you did. I listened to Glenn Beck quite a bit, and I don't ever remember him saying that the Katrina victims were all scumbags, and I'm not sure where you got that.
I got it from Media Matters, and they've got the audio and the exact date right on their website. You go to mediamatters.org, you'll find it.
Well, did you take them out of context, you think? Is that...
Go check it out on MediaMatters.org.
No, hey, I'm wondering why CNN didn't offer you the job.
Because I'm not a right winger. I'll tell you, Greg. You know, if I was a right winger, there's so much money I could make. I mean, it's incredible. But that's a whole other
rant. Is that because they're so popular and they tend to portray the truth a little bit better?
No, it's because money is. For what helps money? It's because the large multinational corporations and the folks who are sucking up to them and sucking up to corporate power on the right are feeding themselves. That's the bottom line, and I'm not doing it. I'm sorry, I'm not going along with it. It's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right wing think tank. We'll be back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Tom Hartman radio program.
Yes, my friend.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics. 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Give them a call and say hi. Smalldog.com, their website. Get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh. Really all things computer. You know, it's even beyond just Macintosh. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, our sound clip of the day.
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him. I'll be honest with you. Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
There you go. Yeah. Is it Joden in St. Paul, Minnesota?
Oh, that's right, Joden.
Hey, Joden. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm just calling. What I'm doing is I'm hosting one of the protest rallies for worldcan'twait.org. Great Air America has been putting on those spots all throughout the day, and I thought I'd go ahead and give a call and let you know of one locally here in Minnesota that I'm hosting.
Great. Give it a plug.
And, yeah, I don't know if we have many people from Minnesota listening, but...
you must have a few, because the next caller is also from Minnesota, so...
Oh, great. Well, then at least they'll know.
Yeah, there you go.
But what's happening is at the Federal Building in downtown Minneapolis, Minneapolis Federal Building at 300 South 4th Street in Minneapolis. That's on January 31st. At 7:30 p.m., and all the information can also be found on the worldcan'twait.org website.
There you go.
Or they can also contact my organization, or you can find us on the web at beingism.org.
Great. Joden, thank you very much for the call and for the information. And, in fact, worldcan'twait.org, an organization that I've personally endorsed. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program. Another
hey,
Minnesotan. Boy, what are you?
Right. It's got all the information now. We're a blue state. So.
There you go.
You know, I wanted to, you talked about, you know, framing language, distortion of language and definitions and how they try to do it. You were using the example Democrat, you know, to make it sound like rat.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm finding, today we had a debate here in your chat room, even liberals do not get the differences between socialism, communism, democracy, and I find liberals defending socialism when they should just stick with democracy. They're falling into the trap of because the cons, they equate democracy as socialist. So I find liberals, I try to tell, you know, my friend, you just stick with democracy.
Yeah, that's enough. It's enough. Democracy is ruled by we the people.
Right.
Or if you want to get super hyper-technical about it, which seems to please even the right-wingers, you can say we live in a constitutionally limited democratic republic.
Right, because they like the word republic, right.
Right, yeah, they want the word. Well, and also the early founders referred to this as a republic, and they distinguished it from a democracy because the old Greek democracy, Madison talks about this at some length in Federalist number 10, as I recall, and also in Federalist 24, maybe Federalist 14, I'd have to go back and look, that they didn't want it simply to be ruled by the majority. They also wanted there to be rights held by the minority. And
sure.
So that's why Jefferson, when he started what is today called the Democratic Party, originally brought together two groups, the Republicans and the Democrats, and
right.
and created the Democratic Republican Party. And it held that name until Andrew Jackson's presidency in the 1830s, as I recall, when they dropped the Republican end off, you know, off the end of it as the Whigs were imploding and started referring to themselves as Democrats. But there was a period of time there from around 1887, mid-1887, when James Madison first made the distinction between democracy and a republic. And
right.
he made that distinction very clearly and artificially as a tool to sell the Constitution. From that time until around 1820, where people believed that there was a significant difference between the two, largely since 1820, the words have been interchangeable, as they were before 1787.
But, Tom, I think you should take an hour sometime next week and help your listeners win the water cooler wars of the definitions, because I find liberals defending socialism, which means and implies autocratic Marxism. We don't want to be defending that.
Yeah, well, and this is the problem. I mean, people call and they say, we had somebody calling a couple of days ago, Tom, talking about this and saying,
right.
you know, we want to be like more like Sweden, for example, or Norway.
It's a democracy.
Exactly.
Right.
And
regulated markets. That doesn't mean socialism. But I have guys in your.
But there are many people in Europe, actually, who live under that, and there are actually political parties who call themselves socialists and define it as that kind of democracy. My grandfather called himself a socialist. He was not a Marxist. He was in favor of essentially the way Norway looks right now. He immigrated from Norway in 1917 to the United States. And
yeah, but he didn't mean like your jeans and your shoes and your T-shirts to be owned by the state, right?
No,
right.
He didn't. Not at all. What
but
he meant was strong labor unions and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
I mean,
even our liberal friends fall into this trap.
I know, and that's that. Well, maybe it's a trap, or maybe it's just, you know, there's a lot of confusion out there, because part of the problem is that Karl Marx reinvented the word socialist, or maybe he invented it. I don't. You know, I've heard people actually say that Marx was the first to use that word. I don't know if that's the case or not.
Right.
But Marx, you know, that's why it was called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And so, yeah, I agree with you, Tom. I absolutely agree with you. We need to just, you know,
educate your listeners and for the water cooler wars. I think this is the Rosetta Stone. That's what holds this whole house of cards for the Republicans.
Yeah. No, you just did it, Tom, and I appreciate it. Jay in Humboldt County, we've got a half a minute left. Hey, Jay.
Hi there. Listen, this is an older, I didn't make this up, but anyway, years ago, a Democratic politician said to the Republicans, if you're going to knock off a syllable and call us the Democrat Party, we'll do you the same favor and call you the Republican Party.
But Republican doesn't sound quite as bad as Democrat.
A publican, if you read the Bible, it's not a good place to be.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You'd have to have a theological grounding, I guess, to because
okay.
otherwise it sort of sounds like the public, you know, and that's, yeah, interesting. Jay, thanks a lot. That's a good one. Had a good way to end this segment. Oh, my. Osama bin Laden speaking out, George W. Bush bumbling through.
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on
him. Yeah, there you go. And that, of course, from 3 years ago. And that's why bin Laden, if he's still around, is still around. Surprise, surprise. 57 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The U.S. Supreme Court appeared likely on Wednesday to close the courtroom door on a form of big class action lawsuit brought by investors that U.S. business groups say would impose enormous liability on American corporations. This is from the Financial Times. Why it is that we have to turn to the Financial Times to learn about what the U.S. Supreme Court is doing, I'm not sure. But anyhow, the Financial Times did a really good job of reporting on what John Roberts is up to in Washington, D.C. in the Supreme Court. Now, of course, the Financial Times, being the British equivalent of the Wall Street Journal, their take on it, actually the article doesn't much have a take, but by and large it's presented as John Roberts, the champion of industry, protecting businesses from the little guy. See, here's how it works. If Granny and her savings get wiped out, or for that matter, if you or I and our savings get wiped out because we happen to put it in a stock, and this, by the way, is a fairly common thing now in the United States where people have 401ks and companies put, and this is their only retirement, and companies encourage them to put their, that company's, you know, use that 401k to buy that company's stock, is what happened to Enron. If you put your money into the stock of a corporation and the insiders in that corporation, by illegal means, by fraud, rip off the corporation to the point that the stock falls, then what happened in 1998 was they passed a law saying that if you want to sue, you're going to have to go to federal court with a class action lawsuit. You can't do it in state court. And so now what's before the Supreme Court is whether that law is constitutional. Whether or not you and I and Granny should be allowed, if some corporation rips us off, to go into a state court where it's a lot easier to file a lawsuit and sue a company and say, hey, you know, I'd like some of my money back because you guys committed fraud. We're talking about clear cases of crimes being committed. And the AARP, for example, the lobby group for retired people, notes the Financial Times, says blocking such suits would hurt older people who tend to hold stocks for the long term. You get my point? In fact, David Frederick, who's the lawyer for the plaintiffs, he said that if you were to bar these kinds of suits, in other words, if you prevent the average person from being able to sue a corporation for fraud in state courts, that it would allow Merrill Lynch to assert immunity for a fraud perpetrated against a category of victim of fraud who has no federal remedy. Because basically what's happened is you can it takes the bar is set so high right now to sue in federal court that it's nearly impossible. And you're forbidden from doing it in state court. So the AARP and these other plaintiffs, they came in and they said, hey, you know, we think that if we get ripped off, we should be able to sue in state court. Or lower the bar, make it easier to sue in federal court. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Now that you understand what's happening, you know, what the stakes are here, whether or not you can sue when a business has committed fraud, when people inside, senior executives inside a company have committed fraud, and as a result of that, they make out like bandits, and you and I, who might be the stockholders, or you and me and Granny, who are the stockholders, I keep saying Granny because the AARP is the main group that's fighting this thing, although I'm old enough to be a member, but in any case, that, you know, that we wouldn't, that we should have the right, that we should have the right to sue. So here I just read you from the Financial Times today. Business appeared to have several supporters among the justices. Justice Antonin Scalia said such suits, quote, lend themselves to abuse much more than purchaser and seller claims, end quote. And Chief Justice John Roberts was even more blunt. He told the lawyer for the plaintiffs in the case, quote, what your clients want to do is cash in on fraud, end quote. Yes, John Roberts, that's the whole point of it. John Roberts saying, if you're the victim of a fraud in a company, you know, Enron tanks, and you want to be able to sue Enron or sue Ken Lay and try and get back some of that money, you shouldn't be able to do it because, according to John Roberts, you're trying to cash in on that fraud. Do you get this? I mean, we're talking, this is why I've, you know, when Roberts was going through the confirmation hearings, I said over and over and over again on this program, and those of you who listen regularly will remember it well, I'm sure, because I probably got so repetitive some of you were starting to get your eyes were starting to cross from it. But over and over I said, you know, Roberts is probably going to be a vote against Roe v. Wade, and that's a serious issue. And he's probably going to be a vote against, for example, the Oregon assisted suicide law or against medical marijuana. Those are serious issues. But in my opinion, the biggest issue, the issue that's ultimately going to decide whether or not democracy stands or falls in the United States of America. And if we don't have democracy, then, you know, Roe v. Wade and everything else, you can kiss everything goodbye. That the issue that stands above everything else is the issue of the power of accumulated wealth in the corporate form versus the power of we the people through our elected representatives. The relationship of the power relationship between corporations and government. And that Roberts and Scalia and Thomas consistently, I pointed out, Scalia and Thomas consistently come down on the side of corporate power, and that Roberts would join them, and that Bush is about stacking this court not just with people who will pander to the right-wing religious zealots among his base. That's a twofer. That's an add-on. That's a bonus. That's the icing on the cake. The cake is that he's stacking the court with corporatists. You'll recall it was Benito Mussolini who, back in the 1920s, looking at the history of modern Italy after in the 1840s or 1870s, I forget which when it was, when Italy fought the war against the Catholic Church and seized back a whole bunch of the land and drove the Catholic Church back. You know, the Catholic Church used to control a big chunk of Europe, I mean, right into the 19th century, all the way up into this, all the way up to Scandinavia. And Italy fought against them and drove them back into what is now Vatican City. And then the governments kept falling over and over and over again. It still is. You know, the Italian governments just don't tend to last very long. And so Mussolini came to power in Italy and he said, how can we create a government in a democracy? I mean, here, let's give the guy the benefit of the doubt and assume that he was trying to do the best thing for Italy. Because I really think he was. He was trying to do the best thing for himself, too. But, you know, how can we create a government that won't fall like every other Italian government has fallen? And he looked around and he said, well, the government has the power of the state. Government has the power to, you know, put a gun in somebody's face and say, you've got to follow the law. But it doesn't have the economic power. And the economic power is where the real power lies. Yes, the police can kick in your door. And, you know, we want to restrain appropriately police power and things like, you know, George Bush snooping on our phone calls. But the real money is with the corporations. And so Mussolini said, let's do away with this elected stuff and replace the elected officials with corporate representatives. Let's merge business and government. And he dissolved Parliament and replaced it with the Cameo de Fascistio Corporaciones, pardon my bad Italian, the Chamber of the Fascist Corporations. And if you lived for example, if you lived in Washington State, if this were to happen in the United States, instead of being represented by Cantwell and Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray, you would be represented by Bill Gates, biggest corporation in the state. You lived in Oregon, you'd be represented by Phil Knight. and so on down the list. You lived in Michigan, you'd be represented by somebody from the Ford family. And he called this fascism after the fasce, the bundle of sticks that was the symbol of the ancient Roman Empire. And he said, now we'll have a form of government that will be stable because the power of money and the power of the state will be merged. And that is, in my mind, what Roberts is all about, what Thomas is all about, what Scalia is all about, and what Alito is all about, and certainly what George W. Bush is all about, and one of my major concerns. And Roberts just confirmed it, 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman here with you. Jeffrey Kleinman is with us. He's the editor of DVDTalk.com, an online DVD and movie magazine. DVDTalk.com is the place you can check it out. Hey, Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great. New DVDs out?
Some great ones.
Tell me about it.
Well, first one is the documentary Enron, The Smartest Men in the Room.
Now, I saw that in the theater, and I got to tell you, it is a brilliant, brilliant movie.
Yeah, you know, in times you think, is this a fictional film that I'm watching? This could never have happened.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it is jaw-dropping. Yeah,
Jeff Skilling with his macho motorcycle and all this stuff. And
it's amazing. I mean, to me, there's a moment in the film where there's a trader who's on the phone with a power plant, and he's basically saying, hey, you guys want to shut that power plant down for a while? And you're thinking, somebody actually could get on the phone and talk to a power plant and have them shut down a power plant to raise rates in California.
Well, in fact, let me just share with you a little clip here. This is actually a montage of clips, a couple of which appear in this movie. Here we go.
Burn, baby, burn. That's a beautiful thing.
You just f*** California. He steals money from California to the tune of about a million.
Can we rephrase that?
Okay. He arbitrages the California market to the tune of $1 million a day.
If you took down a steamer, how long would it take to get it back up?
Oh, it's not something you want to just be turning on and off every hour. Let's
put
it that way.
Well, why don't you just go ahead and shut her down?
And taking all the money back from you guys? All the money you guys stole from those poor grandmothers of California?
Yeah, Grandma Millie, man.
Yeah, now she wants her f***ing money back for all the power you charged right up, jammed right up her f***ing $250 a megawatt hour.
It'd be great. I'd love to see Ken Lai be Secretary of Energy.
Yeah, so these are all from tapes made from the trading floor actually here in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. I mean, these sound like frat boys talking about a party.
Yeah, and these guys were handling billions of dollars, and they were shutting down all the power to California and driving up the prices of energy in California and ultimately bringing down Gray Davis. And this was, by the way, right after Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was then just a movie actor, had this secret meeting with Ken Lay.
Yeah, it's really amazing. One of the other points that comes up in the film, you know, is that, you know, when these guys were pitching these fraudulent schemes and such, they were meeting with, you know, Citibank and Merrill Lynch and companies that, you know, are kind of linchpins of the financial institutions. So, you know, you see a movie like Enron, The Smartest Men in the Room, and it really gives you pause about kind of where we are right now.
Now, Jeffrey Kleinman, editor of DVDTalk.com, you also suggest Lord of War is a new DVD that we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, this basically, Nick Cage plays a gun runner, and he's kind of chased around the world by Ethan Hawke, who's in Interpol. And, you know, it's a great kind of Hollywood adventure, but we've seen a couple of these films out lately that have a real key social theme into it. And this film kind of proposes that, you know, what does it mean when the United States and Great Britain, Russia and France, who are all the permanent seats on the U.S. Security Council, are the world's largest arms dealers?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kind of looks at, you know, one guy's journey through the arm dealer, you know, space, and kind of as a microcosm of, well, you know, what happens when we sell loads of guns to one of the African nations. Where do those guns go to, and what happens to them? And it's a real stark and shocking issue.
But this isn't a documentary, Lord of War. This is a thriller.
Right, it's a thriller, and
it's a big budget Hollywood thriller.
Yeah, I mean, and we had talked the other week about Constant Gardner, and I think Lord of War kind of fits in this theme of big Hollywood blockbuster films that have on the underside a socially relevant theme to them, and I think it's kind of making the issues a lot more palatable out there to entertain, but then people can walk away and go, wait a second, gun running, guns, arms sales,
Yeah, yeah. Jeffrey Kleinman, editor of DVDTalk.com, Junebug.
Junebug. Now, this is a great little film. It came out of Sundance last year, and it deals with the issues of families that come together and the different values people have. A woman and a man come from Chicago. He's from North Carolina, back home to North Carolina, to do a business deal, and then they stay with his family. And so you've got kind of red state, blue state families together, and the dynamics are interesting. There's a lot of talk about can the conservative and liberal sides get along? Well, what happens when you're in the same family and you're all in the same house together?
As is so often, I think probably more the rule than the exception across America. I mean, I think all of us have conservatives in our family and progressives in our families at some level, somewhere,
yeah,
that we have to deal with, as this movie Junebug. And then finally, you said the Aristocrats.
Oh, this is so funny. This is another documentary premiered last year at Sundance. It's finally on DVD. And basically, it's 100 comedians who tell the same legendary dirty joke. And this dirty joke goes back to, George Burns, and it was Johnny Carson's favorite joke. And, really, the documentary looks at really the state of comedy and comedians. And it does obviously touch on obscenity and talks about George Carlin and his battle with the Supreme Court. Great documentary.
Sounds fascinating. Jeffrey Kleinman, DVDTalk.com. Jeffrey, thanks so much for giving us an overview of what's out now on DVD.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Great talking with you, Jeffrey. It's 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann program.
Welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartmann radio program, where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Welcome back to our program. Today, the 25th anniversary of the freeing of the hostages in Iran. The hostages, 25 years ago this day, the hostages who had been taken hostage during Jimmy Carter's presidency, during the last months of Jimmy Carter's presidency, were freed. At the same hour, in fact, nearly at the same moment, that Ronald Reagan put his hand on the Bible to take the oath of office and was sworn in. In her book, October Surprise, Did the Reagan-Bush Election Campaign Sabotage President Carter's Attempts to Free the American Hostages in Iran? Barbara Honegger, who in 1980 was part of the Reagan-Bush campaign, and then in 1981, the Reagan-Bush transition team, and throughout 1981 worked in the White House Office of Policy Development as a research and policy analyst, later worked with the Department of Justice. Back cover of her book has a picture of her shaking hands with Ronald Reagan on her left, on her right, and George Herbert Walker Bush on her left. Barbara Honegger wraps up her book, October Surprise, with an epilogue. A kinder, gentler nation. President Reagan, she says, signed intelligence authorization. Yeah, let me just set this up. The basic argument that she makes, the crime that she documents, is that when the hostages were taken in the summer of 1980, during the election campaign between Jimmy Carter on the one hand and Ronald Reagan on the other, with George Herbert Walker Bush as his running mate, that George Herbert Walker Bush, the former head of the CIA, saw this as an opportunity, or maybe somebody on his campaign staff, maybe even Karl Rove, who knows, saw this as an opportunity to bring down Jimmy Carter, who was 6, 8, 10, 12 points, depending on which month you looked at, ahead of Reagan in the polls. Everybody thought of Reagan as a right-wing crackpot. In fact, George Herbert Walker Bush had run against Reagan in the primaries by calling Reagan a right-wing crackpot. He referred to Reagan's economic policies as voodoo economics. So nobody expected Reagan was going to win this thing. It was like Goldwater versus LBJ, another right-winger going up against a, you know, relatively moderate Democrat. Nobody expected Reagan was going to win it. And then the hostages were taken, and Jimmy Carter couldn't get the hostages back. And he tried, and he sent a mission in there, and they failed, and the helicopter blew up, and some more Americans died, and everybody around America had yellow ribbons tied around their trees out in front of their houses, and he had the whole country praying, and it was all a very depressing time. And rather than telling us, we're going to win this, we're going to have victory, and all the rah-rah like you're hearing out of the Bush administration, Carter was telling us the truth about his attempts at negotiation and his attempts at getting these guys out and his failures. And it hurt him so badly that by Election Day, Carter was down in the polls 5-6 points, and Reagan became president. Had the hostages been released any time before the election, Jimmy Carter would have won. And so Barbara Honegger suggests, as have many others, but she documents it, and she actually worked on the Reagan-Bush transition team in 1980. She says what happened was that when those hostages were taken, George Herbert Walker Bush and associates, in particular, William Casey, who was their campaign manager, then later made head of the CIA, and Amiram Neer, these two guys primarily, and also Cyrus Hashemi, went over there and negotiated with the Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti and Sadegh Gotsbadzah. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce these Iranian names very well. The former U.S. chief of SAVAK, they negotiated with these guys and basically said, if you guys hang on to these hostages long enough to damage Carter politically so that Reagan can win the presidency, then we will sell you the spare parts for the missiles that we have been withholding from you, because the entire Iranian army, militia, the army, navy, air force, everything, had been supplied by the United States when the Shah of Iran was in power. And these guys had kicked the Shah out, and then they took these hostages, and they needed spare parts. They needed missiles. And people have been wondering ever since, why is it that Bush and Reagan, or Reagan and Bush, sold Iran missiles? And Barbara Honegger says, well, because they cut a deal. You hold the hostages so that Reagan gets to be president, we'll give you the missiles and the spare parts. And this is called, you know, the Iran hostage, the Iran-Contra scandal, remember? And then the Contra part of it got dragged into it later. So anyhow, in her epilogue, today, the 25th anniversary of the release of those hostages, she writes, President Reagan signed intelligence authorizations in 1984 and 1985, which were considered licenses to kill, according to top government officials. As we have seen, Oliver North and Amiram Neer's U.S.-Israeli covert operations were authorized by a still-secret accord, never revealed by the Congressional Intelligence Committees, as required by law, which may have also authorized political assassinations in the name of counterterrorism. We have seen that Vice President George Bush met with Amiram Neer in late 1986, when he could have signed the accord with Israeli Prime Minister Peres, for whom Neer worked. Author Seymour Hersh has charged Oliver North with being President Reagan's assassination planner. We have reviewed reports that North boasted that anyone who leaked or threatened to leak the administration's secret Iran initiative would be killed, and that for some of the North Secord Hakim team were reportedly involved in political assassinations under the umbrella of counterterrorism. Given this context, it is instructive to note what has happened to many of the individuals who were reportedly involved in or knew about secret negotiations between Iran and the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign and or secret U.S. arms deliveries to the Khomeini regime in the early 1980s. And what follows is a list of names and short, you know, one-paragraph summaries. Dead. William Casey, CIA director, who reportedly attended meetings in Paris, France, on October 19 and 20, 1980, with Iranian officials and agents of French intelligence to arrange an arms-for-hostages delay deal with Iran. The morning of his first scheduled under-oath testimony, now get this, Casey, the director of the CIA, had been the chairman of the Reagan-Bush campaign. He had been called before the Senate. The Democrats controlled the Senate at the time. He had been called before the Senate to testify under oath about whether or not he was part of a plan to steal the 1980 election. And in exchange for the Iranians holding the hostages, sell them missiles. As Barbara Honegger writes, the morning of his first scheduled under oath testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the Secret Iran Initiative, he was struck by seizures in his CIA headquarters office in Langley, Virginia, and underwent speech incapacitating left brain surgery, searched shortly thereafter. You know, the mafia, they cut your tongue out. In William Casey's case, what they did is they took him to the hospital, they opened up his skull, and they cut out the what's called Broca's region, the left temporal lobe of the brain, the part that controls speech. They cut out his tongue. He died shortly thereafter. Had he lived to testify, according to lifelong friend and counsel Milton Gould, this was his lawyer, Casey would have told the entire truth. Dead. Amiram Nir, this is the guy who helped set the thing up, died November 30, 1988 in a plane crash in Mexico. Nir, who resigned in March 1988, had been, she just goes through the whole thing, when Oliver North sought to, I don't want to get into all the didactic stuff, dead. Cyrus Hashemi, died in Lebanon on July 21st, 1986, 2 days after being diagnosed with a rare virulent form of fast-acting cancer. According to self-proclaimed CIA pilot Richard Brennecke, Hashemi had been a participant in the October 20, 1980 Paris meeting with 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign manager William Casey, Iranian arms dealer Lashau Ghalavi, Iranian officials and agents of Fresh Intelligence, to work out the original arms for hostage delay deal with Iran. Dead, the Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, who reportedly sent a personal representative to the next pre-election Paris meetings of October 1980 with the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign manager William Casey. Dead, Sadek Gotsabah, the foreign minister of Iran at the time of the U.S. Embassy hostage crisis. Dead, William Buckley, CIA station chief in Beirut, Lebanon at the time of the hostage crisis. Dead, U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, Arnold Raphael, in a sabotage plane crash. He was fully briefed on the Reagan-Bush administration's secret Iran initiative. Dead, former Iranian President Mohammad Ali Raji. Dead, Richard Beale, special assistant to President Reagan for national security, died in his 30s. Dead, Donald Fortier, deputy to national security advisors Robert McFarlane and John Poindexter, number three man on the National Security Council. Dead, Glenn Salhem, murdered after going into business with Adnan Khashoggi, the Iranian arms dealer who purportedly helped set this thing up. Dead, Mehdi Hashemi, head of Khomeini's office for the export of militant Islamic fundamentalism, helped set this thing up. Dead, Abby Hoffman, social activist who was found dead in his home on April 12, 1989. Press reports of Hoffman's death noted that he had been depressed about an automobile accident which had occurred some months before. This accident happened just before Mr. Hoffman was to deliver his manuscript entitled An Election Held Hostage to Playboy magazine's offices in Chicago in the summer of 1988. The article, which was published in Playboy's October 1988 issue, is a summary of the October surprise story. Today, the 25th anniversary of the release of the hostages in Iran, those hostages being held, being the single event that caused Ronald Reagan to win the 1980 election, Barbara Honegger suggesting that these were the people who were involved in the deal that Bush and Reagan cut, the October surprise deal, to hold those hostages so that Jimmy Carter would look bad and lose the 1980 election. And the assassination list, by the way, goes on for another 20 pages. Amazing. So that anniversary honored today. And it's a good reminder, and you can still... October surprise, by the way, her publisher got bought out right after the book came out and vanished. You can still occasionally find used copies on the web. It's 11:45. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels.
Yeah, it sounds like a plan. So do I. Welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Here, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Welcome back to our program. Boy, amazing what is going on the internet out here. Yahoo aided Chinese investigation of journalists. Chinese journalist, this from the Progress Report, Xin Tao, recently received a 10-year prison sentence for posting a communication from Communist Party authorities on a New York-based Chinese language website. Yahoo provided records showing that, this is a quote, that she used a computer at his workplace, Contemporary Business News, in Changsha, late in the evening of April 20, 2004, to access his Yahoo email account. The company explained they must balance legal requirements against our strong belief that our active involvement in China contributes to the continued modernization of the country, end quote. Yahoo, turning this guy in. He's in 10 years in prison. Cisco provides internet censoring enabling equipment. Cisco Systems has been selling the filtering equipment to China that helps censor and block websites. Cisco says it doesn't participate in government censorship but acknowledges that its equipment can be used to filter access. Cisco spokesperson placed the blame elsewhere, saying, our perspective is it's the user, not Cisco, that determines the functionality and uses to which the technology is put. Yeah, that's the whole point. That's why they're trying to prevent Iran from having nuclear technology. It's the user. Chinese Google News leaves out banned news outlets. If you're in China, you get a different Google News return than you do if you're in the United States. Google says showing American headlines would likely result in Google News being blocked altogether in China. MSN shuts down a blog at China's request. Chinese journalist Xiao Jing, wrote under the name Michael Ante, wrote about the firing of editors at a Chinese newspaper last month in an MSN Spaces-hosted blog. By December 30, Microsoft had shut him down. Microsoft's senior manager reportedly said any content which breaks national laws must be taken down. Amazing. And then there's a company, Fortinet, internet-based company in California, reportedly developed a system for the repressive Myanmar government, this is the old Burma, to filter web content. This is probably one of the most autocratic and repressive governments on the planet. They're right up there with North Korea. The software upgrade, quote, may have made censorship even more efficient and widespread in the country, end quote. It's related to the problems that Yahoo and Microsoft and others are facing in China, Harvard's John Palfrey said. But here the issue is these technology security companies are directly profiting from the censorship regime itself. Holy cow. Holy cow. What have we come to? It's, grim times these. I got to tell you, grim times these. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Billy in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Billy, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on KRXA.
Hey. That was a great intro to what I called to say, my friend.
Okay, what did you call to say?
So Google is down over 30 points today.
Google is?
I don't know if you were following it today.
No, I haven't. I haven't been following their stock. You think because of this story?
Well, that's what I'm going to tell you, exactly. Google's down 30 points. The market's down 160. We're about to go into a major recession caused by the spying on Americans by the Bush administration. We also found out yesterday that Google's being pressured by Bush to give all of their records, and they keep every search we do, Tom.
But they're pushing back. Google,
they are pushing back.
Google is the only company that's been pushing back. Yahoo turned the documents over. MSN turned the documents over. But Google has been pushing back.
Two questions for you, Tom. A, whether they push back or not, do you doubt that the CIA friends of Bush can find a way in to get them on their own?
Yeah, and B, if they're willing to give in to the Chinese government, how long is it going to be before they give in to the American government?
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
So, in fact, what I'm suggesting to you is that, and this is, we're always talking about corporations. Well, here the government is going to cause the biggest corporate loss of money ever by their spying tactics, because there's about to be what they call a chill put on the growth of the Internet. What do you think?
Well, I think it's entirely possible. In fact, there was an article, I don't have it in front of me, that I saw yesterday that pointed out that there's a number of countries that are creating their own internets right now so that they can, make them more user-friendly for the folks in their country or with their language. So, I see this going in some very strange directions, Billy, and I'm right there with you. Thanks for calling and raising this issue. It's a good one. Richard in Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind?
How you doing? I was just, I do a lot of listening anyway. I listen to a lot of these talk shows, and you hear these Republicans say to the Democrats, what are you going to do about the war? I just wish one would just turn it around and say, what are you going to do about the war? Instead of trying to say what they're going to do about the war, because there's no real answer. There's no real answer to everything when they ask you a question.
Well, they got this answer of, we're going to stay the course, you know.
Yeah, that's not an answer.
Yeah, I know. I know. You know that, and I know that, but the average American doesn't, tragically. Richard, good point. Thank you for making it. I appreciate it. Dick in Seattle. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, you know, I'm concerned about this apology you mentioned by Harry Reid. You know, if Harry Reid is apologizing for telling the truth about the GOP, and he's our leader, I mean, we're in serious trouble as a party.
I agree.
We need to be urging, I think, our senators to have him resign immediately so we can have a leader, you know, who isn't afraid of a fight, who's not a sissy. We keep getting these sissies for leadership.
And who would you suggest, Dick?
Well, Barbara Boxer comes to mind, Ted Kennedy. These are people who can lead us.
Yep.
And, you know, in regards to that October surprise anniversary, I found Robert Perry's site, consortiumnews.com, has excellent stuff. You can also reach that through Real History Archives.
Oh, yeah, you can easily Google this stuff, unless you're in China.
Great stuff there.
Yeah. Okay, Dick, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. I appreciate it. I gotta say, special thanks to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, and Dan Jacobs over at Air America, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on this website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thanks so much. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, conservative Chuck Morse says the Republicans are going to do well in 2006. Will they? That and the best of the rest of the news on the Tom Hartman program, the place where smart people get their news. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.